All right. So today we're actually going to start chapter 21. And back in 19, we started the third journey. And today in 21, we're actually going to finish the third journey. When we look at the third journey, Paul was in Ephesus for a while, and then he went up through Macedonia. He caught up with Timothy. He also caught up with Titus. And then Luke was probably there in Philippi as well. And they go down to Greece or Achaia, which is, probably help if I look at a map here, but those are the actual areas where they went to, but let's see if I can pull it up in just a second. When you look at this map in the very first part, in chapter 18 and 19, which is this gray line right here, they started off in Antioch and they went over here, but then they spent a lot of time in Ephesus, and then they, in chapter 19, was pretty much dedicated to Ephesus. And then chapter 20, they traveled up through Troas and then back down to Achaia, Greece area down here, stay. I believe when they were over in the Philippi area, that's when 2 Corinthians was written to them, because Paul mentions that this is the third time that I'm coming to you. Then he goes down to Corinth, and this is where I believe the book of Romans was written as well. And then they go back up through Troas, and the gentleman that was sitting at the window listening to a long sermon fell out of the window, and Paul ran down there and revived him. And we really left Paul on the beach last week with the Ephesian elders, and they were saying this warm goodbye. And anyone remember what Paul was saying to them, or the main point that he was trying to communicate to them? What was the message that he was trying to get across to the elders?
For themselves, that from among them dangerous wolves would come.
Yep. So there were going to be these savage wolves that were among the elders already. And Paul was really trying to tell them, hey, look out for this. Be alert. Be on guard for what's going to happen. But the other part of that message, too, is Paul was saying to them, hey, I have spent so much time here with you guys. I have done my work. It's up to you guys now to carry it on and be alert for what's going to happen, because bad things are going to happen. So, all right. Any questions or thoughts through 20? All right, 21. Chapter 21, verse 1. It says, when they had parted from them and set sail, we came by a straight course to Kos, and then set the next day to Rhodes. And from there, to Patara. And having found a ship crossing over to Phoenicia, when they set abroad and set sail, when they had come sight of Cyprus, leaving it on the left, we sailed to Syria and landed there at Tyre, for there was a ship that was to unload its cargo. So we can see that Paul here with the Ephesian elders, he had a very emotional departing from them. And every year when we go to Cascade Friends, or the kids camp that we volunteer at for that week, we start on Sunday afternoon after services, and then we go throughout the entire week until Friday. But once that Thursday comes, there's this general mood at camp where everybody's just like sad, because you're not going to see a lot of these people for about a year. And there's this general sadness that goes on that Thursday, because you have so much time with these people during the week that you want to spend with them, and you're having such a good time and you get to know them so well. You just don't want to see it in. And Paul here, with the same thing, he just spent so much time with them that he didn't want to see that thing in. Do you think that every church should feel those same emotions that Paul felt with those elders? It's not a trick question. Yeah, I mean, we should have a really close connection with each other. And then when you start thinking about how that happens, how do you think we can have a close connection with each other? What types of things do we need to be doing to have those close connections, or foster those close connections? Know our brethren. Yeah? How do you do that?
Yeah.
I'm going to call you out.
What?
I'm going to call you out.
Well, I haven't woke up yet.
Okay.
Communicate with each other. Offer to help each other. Pray for each other.
Spend time with each other by praying for each other, communicating with each other, helping each other out. Those, as you work, that's one of the things that I found is when you work with people, you generally get to know them and you'll develop those close connections. But if you stand on the sidelines or off to the side and don't participate or don't get involved, then you're never really going to develop those close connections and that family bond that we're trying to go for that this group had with Paul. That's never going to be realized. So you got to get involved. It mentions that they go by the islands of Kos and Rhodes. Rhodes, I'm going to butcher this word, it's the Dodecanese Islands, and Rhodes was really capital. The whole island is the Island of Roses, that's what it's named, and I guess there's a lot of roses, which is odd in the sense that I was Googling, searching for pictures of this island for roses, and I could not find a single picture of the Island of Roses, but that's what everybody calls it. I guess it's famous for its roses. So the delta, or the difference between Kos and Rhodes, is about 50 miles. So from here to just past the Spokane airport, that would be the distance between those two islands. And then in verse 4 it says, having sought out the disciples, we stayed there for 7 days, and through the Spirit we... not seeing that. Oh yeah, the other thing I wanted to mention here too. So as they're traveling down this path in yellow... there's emotional partner. But this is a picture of Tyre. And you can see this is one of the oldest cities that has been continually inhabited. So you can see some of the old structure. And in the background, there's newer buildings that people still live in today. So they pass through those areas. In verse 4, it says, having sought out the disciples, we stayed there for 7 days. And through the Spirit, they were telling Paul not to go through Jerusalem. So they stayed there for 7 days. Paul would spend some time with the saints at Tyre. And again, when you look back at where Tyre is, it's on the very tip. So they just come from the island of roses down here. They sailed across Cyprus to the left, and then they came over to this city, which is that. The city of Tyre, which is the picture I just showed you. Yep.
So I ask a question. So was Paul just being bullheaded, or was he more inspired than they were? Obviously, they had received news, word from God that bad things were going to happen when he got to Jerusalem. Was he just more committed than they were, or? they tried to warn him.
So they tried to warn him. So there's a couple of different ways you can read that. The first way is the Spirit warning Paul not to go. That's one way that you could read it. Another way you could read it is the Spirit or the saints warning Paul not to go. And we just had saw what from the Ephesian elders? This very closeness, they had this bond, they were sad, right? We're going to see this a couple more times here where Paul is getting ready to leave these places that he visits on his way to Jerusalem. He's got a very close connection to these people. So when you look at it, if you take it from that the Spirit is warning Paul not to go to Jerusalem, to me that conflicts with the previous chapter in Acts chapter 20 and verse 22 through 23, where Paul knows that he's going to be bound in Jerusalem. He knows things are going to happen, right? So, I personally don't believe it's the Spirit warning him.
So you see it more like when Jesus turned to Peter and said, "Satan, get behind me."
Yeah.
This was going to happen. It had to happen.
It had to happen.
He wasn't eager. His friend didn't want him to go through it. But...
Yep. Yeah, because we're going to see another example later, I believe. So, yeah, we're definitely going to see it later where there's a phrase I want to talk about. But... when you look at this, I think this is really the saints are being told by the Spirit what's going to be happening to Paul. I've got Peter in my head for some reason because you just said Peter, so I'm going to keep saying Peter. But When you look at Paul, I think the saints here got message from the Spirit saying, hey, you're going to be persecuted in Jerusalem. And out of their emotion, because they don't want to see Paul hurt, they're telling Paul, hey, don't go to Jerusalem. And this is an example we're going to see a little bit where they want something over what they want to put something ahead of what the Spirit wants or what God wants. So, any thoughts on that piece? No? All right. It says in verse 5, when our days were ended, we departed and went on our journey, and they all, with wives and children, accompanied us until we were outside the city. Kneeling down on the beach, we prayed and said farewell to one another. And when they went on board the ship, they returned home. So you have all this group from Tyre coming out, and this is really the first example where we see, you know, after 7 days had passed, there was children that were in this church, which is, I always think of these things as like really old people and just not really anything that resembles what we have here in Coeur d'Alene, but this is just a glimpse into, there's a variety of people. There's children, there's middle-aged people, and there's old people, and all these churches, so that's it's real, right? And again, we see another example where, very similar to the Ephesian elders, where Paul is kneeling down on the beach here and offering a prayer. So they were praying with each other. Verse 7, when we had finished our voyage from Tyre and arrived to Ptolemais, we greeted the brothers and stayed with them for one day. And on the next day, we departed and came to Caesarea, and we entered the house of Philip the evangelist, who is one of the seven, and stayed with him. So Ptolemais, that's about 25 miles south of Tyre. Again, because we see examples where the ships traveling, unloading their cargo, we have examples of that, so they're traveling here. And when they travel to Caesarea here, we don't know if they continued to go on a ship or if they had walked down there. And Caesarea was about 32 miles, so here to Spokane, south of Ptolemais. And it was named after Caesar Augustus, who and built by Herod the Great. So this is the same Herod that had built the second temple, and then also the same Herod that massacred children who were younger than 2 years old after Jesus was born. So he built the city of Caesarea. And then we know, we can see that from Acts chapter 6, that Philip was one of the seven that were selected to serve the widows. So this is not Philip the apostle. And he is referred to as the evangelist here by Paul, or sorry, by Luke. and that probably goes back to his efforts back in chapter 8, where the people of Samaria, we have Simon the magician, and we also have the Ethiopian eunuch who Philip had worked with. And then in verse 9 it says, he had four daughters who prophesied. So I hope this guy had more than one bathroom in his house. That's all I got to say on that. I mean, it's just, that would be amazing for Sunday services, try to get ready for that. So here, do you remember when in Acts chapter 2, it says, on the last days, God declares that I will pour out my Spirit on all flesh, and your sons and daughters shall prophesy. So that was in Acts chapter 2, right? And here we see an example where Philip's daughters, they were prophesying. We don't know exactly what they said, but we know that they did prophesy. In verse 10, it says, while we were staying for many days, we don't know how many days, a prophet named Agabus came down from Judea, and he was coming to us, and he took Paul's belt and bound his feet and his hands and said, thus says the Holy Spirit, this is how the Jews in Jerusalem will bind the man who owns this belt and deliver him into the hands of the Gentiles. So here we have a prophet coming down. He's using this symbolism to help them understand, or at least help Paul understand, what's going to happen to him as he goes in Jerusalem. That would be a little bit unsettling. I mean, he already knows he's going to be persecuted, but now he knows he's going to be bound, which to me represents him being bound up in prison, or losing his freedom in that sense. And when you, this should be Acts chapter 9, not 19. Ananias, right? Do you remember what happened there when, after Paul's conversion? What did Ananias say? Or what did the book say? about Ananias, the Lord said to Ananias, "Go, for he is a chosen instrument of mine to carry out my name before the Gentiles and the kings and the children of Israel, for I will show him how much he must suffer for my name's sake." So Paul, from the very beginning, God had a plan for him that he was going to suffer. And it's ironic because Paul did much of the persecution to the church early on before he became a Christian. So we can see that Paul here is going to suffer as well. And in verse 12, it says, "When they heard this, we and the people there urged him not to go up to Jerusalem. Then Paul answered, 'What are you doing, weeping and breaking my heart? For I am not ready to only be in prison, but even to die in Jerusalem for the name of the Lord Jesus.' And since he would not be persuaded, we ceased and said, 'Let the will of the Lord be done.'" So, to your point, Roger, I mean, I think this is very similar to where they didn't want him to go because they knew bad things were going to happen. And Paul, his reaction is, "Hey, I'm willing to die for this cause." And that should give us a little bit of comfort in the sense that, you know, there's some internal evidence to the Bible that it's true. Why would you have so many apostles and people willing to put their lives on the line for something if it wasn't true? Right? And this is an example of Paul. This statement, where it says, "Let the will of the Lord be done." Is this a difficult statement to live by for us? Okay. In what ways or examples do you have where people would struggle living by this phrase, "Let the will of the Lord be done"? How does that manifest itself in our lives? When you're going through hard times, yeah, that can definitely be a challenge. Yeah, it's often times where you have to reflect, right? Am I wanting something for my own selfishness, or is this something that I want to do for the Lord? Yeah. Yeah, and it's something David struggled with too, right? Wrestled with that whole process. How about like when we want to get married, right? If you force that situation in the sense that I'm going to go do something about it and maybe perhaps even marry somebody that is not good for you because you want to get married rather than leaving it up to the Lord and letting that happen. How about when we want to see things at work? Well, I can just do this one thing, right? Or I can maybe skip by the law and not follow things to the letter of the law and do things that are maybe selfish or my own ambitions because I want to move forward in the company. Right, Molly?
And there's the times, certainly in my life, where he's asked me to take a leap of faith and, you know, the worldly side of me says, "What's in it for me?"
Yeah.
And also the fear that's involved.
Yeah.
And yet every time I choose to follow his will, there's benefits that I've never anticipated. So.
Yeah. I think that's the key thing.
Being retired, I have a lot of time available to me to do whatever I want. I spend a lot of my time doing exactly whatever I want to do, other things.
Yeah, that's something that I struggle with as well, where if I'm not teaching a class, I will all get to that next tomorrow or the next week, and then I just don't get to it, and I need to get to it, versus having a class where it forces me to spend about 20 hours preparing for something, right? It's just something that it holds you accountable. And it's easy, I think, when, was it Brett when he was here preaching for us? He just mentioned that as he got older, how much the recliner appealed to him, right? And it's easy to go sit and look at that recliner and just sit back and relax and rather than doing what God needs us to do. So, all right. Verse 15, it says, "After these days, we got ready and went up to Jerusalem, and some of the disciples from Caesarea went with us, bringing us to the house of Mnason of Cyprus, an early disciple with whom we should lodge." So we see this individual, they got ready, to go up to Jerusalem. It would have been about a 64-mile journey. We don't know very much about Mnason, but they were going to his house, and we know that he is from Cyprus, which is the same area that Barnabas is from. He probably had a large enough home to accommodate the people that were traveling with Paul at the time. It would have been maybe right around 9 people. And in verse 17, it says, when we had come to Jerusalem, the brothers received us gladly. So we have the church up there. We have all the brethren up there. And they received Paul gladly. What did Paul have with him when he was going around through all these different areas? What was he collecting? While he's going like this. Yeah, he had money with him, right? So they received Paul gladly. They welcomed him, what he was doing there. But as we're going to see in a little bit, there are a bunch of Jews there as well that I believe they're unbelievers because of the way they're reacting. But there are a bunch of Jews from Asia that are going to have some misinformation and start saying things that they shouldn't be saying and doing things they shouldn't be doing, which is going to cause Paul a whole lot of trouble. In Romans chapter 15 and verse 30-32, it says, Paul wrote, I appeal to you, brothers, by the Lord Jesus Christ and by the love of the Spirit, to strive together with me in your prayers to God on my behalf, that I may be delivered from the unbelievers in Judea, and that my service for Jerusalem, so this is the service that Paul is bringing now, and the things that he's doing, may be acceptable for the saints. And we can see that it was acceptable because they gladly received him. So that by God's will, I may come to you with joy and be refreshed in your company. So Paul had hoped to make it through his journey and then hopefully one day be with these people in Rome. And he's going to be delivered from the disobedient Jews that he's going to run into. So in verse 18 of Acts, it says, on the following day, Paul went in with us to James and the elders who were present. So this is in Jerusalem. And after greeting them, he related one by one the things that God had done among the Gentiles through his ministry. And when they had heard it, they glorified God, and they said to him, you see, brother, how many thousands there are among the Jews who have believed. And they're all zealous for the law. And they have been told about you, that you teach all the Jews that are among the Gentiles to forsake Moses, telling them not to circumcise their children or walk according to our customs. So when we look at this, we see an example, again, of elders. It's plural, so there has to be more than one elder. We don't ever see an example in the church where there's just one elder running the show. And we can see here that Paul, again, like he's done previously when he relayed the information to the church in Antioch in Syria, he's giving God the credit for all the things that are going on. So it's important that I think we do that. I was thinking about this over this last week. One of the guys I know over in Seattle asked me, hey, we're going through this process of searching for a preacher. Can you, you know, give me everything that you have done for that whole process of searching? And I'm thinking back going, I don't remember what we did, but I remember God helping a whole lot on finding a preacher. And it's just one of those things where it's really easy to take the credit for something. And Paul had an opportunity to do that. And look at all the things that I've taught and how much time I spent working and how many things I gave up when I was doing this. And he doesn't do that. He gives God the credit there. So here Paul is meeting with the elders in Jerusalem. And it's really interesting because when you start reading this, it feels like these guys are caving in to what's going on with the Jewish culture there and trying to mix the old law and New Testament Christianity together to make people happy. And we can see examples where Paul is, in my mind, he doesn't do that. He basically shuts it out, which he was one of the most zealous people for the law, right? And now he's coming back and he's going to end up doing some things that to help make people, to get people unified in my mind. So when you start thinking about traditions versus commandments, Do we have that in our church today? Do we have traditions that we have versus commandments? What are some examples? Maybe not in this church, but just in general.
Mandatory Wednesday night classes.
Mandatory Wednesday night classes. Yeah.
Tuesday night, people thought we were weird.
Yeah. Yep.
The order of worship, you know, we've kind of taken up this pattern. This is how we learned it wherever we came from, and we use the same pattern. You know, I don't think there's anything wrong with it, unless it's causing someone or you to stumble. You know, and then we got to take a look at it.
Yeah. Do you ever go visit other churches and they have a different order, and you're like, I don't know about this. Why do they wait till the very end to do the Lord's Supper?
Yeah.
I had a long conversation with Charlie about that. It was a very interesting conversation about donating and can you use electronic versus you have to give physical money and just traditions, right? All these traditions that we have. So it's very important that we keep our mind open, right? Because I think a little bit what is going on here in the church in Jerusalem is they have a lot of traditions from the Old Testament that they're trying to bind and make law.
And more than that, there's their families would ostracize them for becoming Christians.
Yeah.
And, you know, I have a good friend who's Catholic. We talk about the Bible all the time. We discuss our faith. And the thing that's keeping him from converting is he would have to turn his back on his family if they turn their back on him.
Yeah. That's hard. Roger?
I think your talks about the people that told them that they're teaching the Jews to forsake Moses and not circumcise them, they're twisting the new law.
Yep.
Don't, you can't circumcise your children. But they're taking it, they're twisting it sound that way. And I think these people are just trying, as elders, they're just trying to use situation there. They're just trying to give him some advice. Do this, and let's not raise this trouble in the church.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, I think it was in chapter 16, what example did we see with Paul, right? 15, they had the Jerusalem Council, and the whole thing about that was circumcision is not required for salvation. They're trying to take things from the old law and bind it on people. And in the very next chapter, in chapter 16, what did Paul do with Timothy? Circumcise them, right? Why did he do that? So we could have unity with the Jews, right? Any roadblocks or barriers that they might have, Paul wanted to remove those barriers. And I think when we see Paul here go through this purification process in the temple, where he's pointed out by the Jews that are from Asia, he does this in order to break down those walls to have unity, right? And that's what's really interesting to me about this whole situation is because Paul is willing to go to these extreme lengths to make sure that the Jews have what they need and remove those roadblocks.
It is a mischaracterization for them to say that Paul was teaching to forsake Moses. He never taught that. In fact, he went the other way and he said that Christ is the fulfillment of what Moses prophesied. And there will come one similar to me and he'll be your eternal king. So they just had it twisted around. And yet I think some of these people apparently were trying to do the right thing, but they were being led astray by this mischaracterization.
Yeah. And just like when we go visit another church and we have the different order of worship at that different congregation, how it makes us feel uncomfortable. That's a small taste of what these Jews probably felt. And Paul knew that. Right, and he's trying to accommodate to that whole situation and make sure that they do that. But on the same side, you've got to have an open mind. You've got to be willing to listen. You've got to be willing to understand, right? So you don't twist those facts around and end up having issues where you're saying, hey, you Paul is teaching us not to be circumcised. Versus, it's okay, you can do that, but don't bind it on people.
And this is a reminder for us to not listen to other people, what other people say, to verify everything with God.
Yeah, we can listen, but we have to like verify with what people are saying. And I think originally when I started this class, we talked about how if I just start spouting off things that are coming out of my mind, you can listen, but it's much more meaningful if it comes out of Scripture. And I think we have several examples where this happens, where they're pulling Old Testament Scripture. That seems how Paul's pattern is when he's speaking to the Jews.
I visited a church occasionally down in Southern California when I made the trip, and it's bilingual. They have Spanish and English. And what sort of taught me a little bit was that when they would pray in the worship service, they would start the prayer in English, break it, and then start it in Spanish and go back and forth like that.
Yeah.
To me, that, yeah, it's the way they do it, but when you're trying to, you're worshiping God, you're praying to God, and things should be done in a way that is not using, which is the Bible teaches.
Yep.
God is not God. What would you say about that?
Yeah, I mean, you want to accommodate things for people as much as you possibly can to make the worship organized.
Yeah.
But at the same time, if that's how it is, and all you can do is voice your concerns, but then do your best with it, right?
Yeah.
It's the same thing with preachers that you may not necessarily like their style of preaching.
Uh-huh.
If they're following the word, we need to be doing our best to just understand it, be patient with it, and learn it. So, it may, because there's not going to be one style for everybody. It's super challenging. I think that's where it goes back to having love and patience and all those things that we're told that we need to have.
I think it goes to, there was a same, similar issue of Forest Grove, because a Spanish group was there also. I think it goes back to using tongues as an example. If you're going to be speaking in a language that everybody doesn't understand, then you have to have someone to interpret. And we dealt with it a little differently. We had a Spanish group met separate time than the English group, but then you have a congregation of Christians in a community, and they're doing two separate meetings. So I don't know what the best solution is on that. You know, you can split it up like they did, and switch back and forth between languages so everybody knows what's being said. Or
yeah, I think that's part of the beauty, though, of God's design, is we have to go figure that out, right? But it definitely would not facilitate having those family connections if you have a group, two different groups meeting, and yeah, it's challenging. All right, verse 22. What then is to be done? So this is the Jewish elders here. They certainly will hear that you have come. Do therefore what we tell you. We have four men under a vow, and these men, and take these men and purify yourself among them and pay their expenses, so that they may shave their heads. Thus all will know that there is nothing for what you have, there is nothing from what have been told about you, but that you yourself also in observance of the law. But as for the Gentiles who have believed, we have sent a letter with our judgment that they should abstain from sacrifice, from things sacrificed to idols and from blood and from things that have been strangled and from sexual immorality. So I think we're going to see in a little bit, there's two different groups here. There's Jewish that group that is unbelieving, and then there's a group that is believing. And really what they're trying to do here is accommodate to those Jews that are the believers within the church. And again, as we pointed out, I think this law, this binding that they're saying that Paul has here, that he's binding that they should forsake the law of Moses, is a misunderstanding in the sense that they shouldn't be circumcised. He would allow that. We saw an example of that. And so we have this plan here where Paul is going to pay these required offerings for these four men. And that really shows this generosity, I guess, if you will. For Paul would be showing this generosity, but he's also obeying or doesn't have a problem with the Old Testament law. So, again, it's really odd to me in the sense that they're trying to go to these extreme lengths to accommodate these people, but I mean, it says there was a lot of people there that were believers, so who knows what could have happened if they would have the opposite reaction.
I know it's not here, but are there other sources that talk about how much money this land represented? Because I keep thinking about the fact that we brought this help for the people who are suffering, and they're going to be paying out money. You know, it offends me, for instance, to see a really fancy church. How many people did that church have fed? I'm wondering about what kind of money we're talking about.
I don't know, honestly. I don't know how much money it is, but they were required to pay a sacrifice, a fee to the Levite or the priest, and Paul was doing that really for them on their behalf.
I think he was paying it out of his own pocket.
Yeah.
I don't think he was having a congregation of funds from the state churches.
Well, that was my point. This is a significant amount.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think it was coming from those contributions that he brought. I think this was from Paul personally doing that, but I don't know how much money that would have been. All right, verse 26, it says, then Paul took the men the next day. He purified himself along with them and went into the temple, giving notice when the days of purification would be fulfilled and the offering presented for each one of them. So, why Paul would agree to this, I think, goes back to just having unity with the Jews and helping them understand that the law here, that Paul agreed with it, wasn't forsaking it in the sense that telling people not to do that. John?
I think 1 Corinthians chapter 9 explains why he caters to different types. If you know, to the Jew, I became a Jew.
Yep. Yep.
I became weak. So
yeah.
I think that explains a lot about all the different things that he went through at that time.
Yeah. Yeah, again, we see that example where Paul is willing to do anything to bring these people to Christ. All right, verse 27, it says, When the 7 days were almost completed, the Jews from Asia, seeing him in the temple, stirred up the whole crowd and laid hands on him, crying out, men of Israel, help! This man who is teaching everyone against the teaching everyone everywhere against the people and the law and this place. Moreover, he even brought the Greeks into the temple and has defiled this holy place, for they had previously seen Trophimus, the Ephesian, with him in the city, and they supposed that Paul had brought him into the temple. So, there's this area in the temple, and there's the court of the Gentiles up there. And what they're saying is, in that center area where the Jews were, that they're saying Paul brought somebody, Trophimus, into that area where only the Jews were allowed in this temple. And they supposed it. They didn't have facts. This was a misunderstanding. They were making up things in a sense. So the group here, I believe, is these Jews that are unbelieving, that are have an issue with Paul, right? And they really start doing things that are not good in the sense that they're spreading rumors and lies here, and it's going to start up a big issue. So, in verse 30, it says, when all the city was stirred up and the people ran together, they seized Paul and dragged him out of the temple, and at once the gates were shut. And I believe those are the gates separating the court of the Gentiles and the Jews there, that they're shutting, trying to prevent the Gentiles in there. And as they were seeking to kill him, word came to the tribune of the cohort, and all the Jerusalem was in confusion. He at once took the soldiers and the centurions and ran down to them. And when they saw the tribune and the soldiers, they stopped beating Paul. So in the corner, which is up on the upper right-hand corner, there's an area. And this was Rome's representation. It was built onto the temple. And that's where the soldiers would have been. And the tribune here, who is the commander of this army, they run down there because of all the confusion that's going on. Because, again, this started when they saw Paul in the temple, and they recognized him, and they thought that Paul had brought a Greek into that main area. So this big commotion starts up. The soldiers run down. They're obviously, the Jews here are beating Paul, But when they see the soldiers and the tribune or the commander come down, they stop beating Paul. So, the tribune here is, his name is Claudius Lysias, and we're going to find that out later on in Acts chapter 23, his name. In verse 33, it says, "Then the tribune came up and arrested him and ordered him to be bound with two chains. And he inquired who he was and what he had done. And some of the crowd were shouting one thing and some another. And as he could not learn the facts because of the uproar, he ordered him to be brought into the barracks." So they ordered Paul to be brought in the barracks here. So a crime is to be assumed here in the sense that the tribune doesn't know what's going on. All these guys are in uproar. Everybody's yelling things, and the tribune here cannot get the facts of the situation. So he's really trying to understand what's going on. In the meantime, they're going to try to take Paul to the barracks. And it says in verse 35, "And when he came to the steps, he was actually carried by the soldiers because of the violence of the crowd, for the mob of the people crying out, 'Away with him!' And as Paul was about to be brought into the barracks, he said to the tribune," so this is the commander, "'May I say something to you?' And he said, 'Do you know Greek? Are you not the Egyptian who recently stirred up a revolt and led 4,000 men of the assassins into the wilderness?' And Paul replied, 'I am a Jew from Tarsus in Cilicia, a citizen of no obscure city. I beg you, permit me to speak to the people.' And when he had given him permission, Paul, standing on the steps, motioned with his hand to the people, and when there was a great hush, he addressed them in the Hebrew language." So, this is really interesting because Paul here, talking to the tribune, we're going to see later that Paul is brought into the barracks and they're about to beat Paul or flog Paul. And Paul makes it very clear at that point that he is a Roman citizen. But why would they even do that if right now he's telling them that he's a Roman citizen? So either they forgot. I don't know. That part's really confusing. So that might be some homework that you want to look into this week. Is at this point, Paul tells them that he's a Roman citizen, but then he goes back and tells them again that he's a Roman citizen. And the commander here acts like it's the first time he's hearing this.
It might be that invoking that Roman citizenship or something, right?
Yeah.
The term.
Yeah.
I would assume the guy was a Roman citizen.
Exactly.
Maybe you actually had to say something specific.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know.
Maybe they just understood he was from that city, but they didn't understand that he had rights as a Roman citizen.
Yeah, I didn't look at it that way, but yeah, it says, "I am a Jew from Tarsus in Sicily, in Sicilia. So maybe he's just from that area and they didn't take it as being born there, as he's going to say later. So good. Yeah, so the final thing I just want to mention, it's really interesting because Paul, even though he's in this situation that would be really uncomfortable, it would his first thought is to go back and start having an opportunity to preach to all these people. And that's just amazing to me. So next week we'll go to chapter 22. And I'll tell you about a story when I was in London. There was a riot. I was in it. So
nice.
We'll go from there. Any thoughts or comments? All right. Thank you.